You can now book for the National Association for Primary Education Conference 2024. This is focusing on SEND challenges and strategies. Join them at the University of Bedfordshire for a day filled with insightful discussion, workshops and networking opportunities. You can attend in person or online by visiting nape.org.uk/conference-2024. That's nape.org.uk/conference-2024.
Hello, my name is Mark Taylor and welcome to the Education on Fire podcast. The place for creative and inspiring learning from around the world. Listen to teachers, parents and mentors share how they are supporting children to live their best authentic life and are proving to be a guiding light to us all.
Hello, welcome back to the Education on Fire podcast. Great to be back with you, and thank you to everyone who's been emailing in, telling me what they've liked about the show. It's great to get your feedback, and that way we can keep it on point and trying to give you the best information and the most inspiring conversations that we possibly can. Now, today I'm delighted to be chatting to Pete Urich, and he's the co-author of Setting and Scoring Financial Goals. This book is an excellent resource for young people looking to improve their financial literacy skills while also enjoying the excitement and energy of football, or as they would say in America, soccer. Hi, Pete. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Education on Fire podcast. I think one of the lessons I've learned the most from chatting to our sort of 360-odd having sort of released, I think 368, I think, went live this week, amazingly, is the fact that it's really a sense that kids, and I think we all learn, when it's relevant to ourselves, our passions, our educational experience, it's not just something from a book or something we've been told to do. And that was why I was really excited to have this opportunity to have a conversation, because I think when you start combining people's passions, their hobbies, their understanding of real life, and mix that into, like, say, the sorts of learnings that we want to sort of take on board, I think it's a really passionate and a really sort of powerful thing. So yeah, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, I'm super happy to be here. It's one of those things that you and I seem to be speaking the same language exactly. So I'm really glad to have a talk with you.
Fantastic. And speaking that language, you know, we've just been chatting about football. It's great to have someone who's a passionate football fan and sort of have that sort of history at its core. So where did that come from, first of all?
My particular background in football starts, you know, back in the 1980s. I don't know how many people in England ever took notice in the 1980s, but Pelé and Beckenbauer and a few other famous players from Europe came over here to the U.S. and played for a variety of different teams. But the principal one was the New York Cosmos. And New York Cosmos, although they were plush with you know, foreign players, there was one American on the team. His name was Ricky Davis. And it just so happened that he came to a party that I was at, and he kicked the ball around with a bunch of us kids. And that was kind of the birth of my football education, if you will. And I started playing and, you know, basically played throughout my youth into my 20s and 30s, and I've been a coach for 24 years. And so that whole entire arc of being a young kid passionate about this sport that at the time in the U.S., I don't want to say nobody cared. That's not an actual true statement, but the amount of eyes that were put onto football in the 1980s weren't as many as we have today. And the access that we have to football today is amazing, just based on the ability to see things on the internet and everything like that. And as we were talking about before we started recording, I'm a fervent Peterborough United posh fan. And I have been for over 20 years now because of the fact that, despite living in the United States, I can pay attention to a small team from England that, you know, although I've only been to two live matches, it's still something that I get extremely passionate about.
Yeah, I love it. And I really love the history that you mentioned there, because, you know, there are many people thinking, you know, it's the stars like Beckham who went to LA and then that suddenly made a difference. And, you know, and currently sort of Messi, obviously, over in Miami. But like I say, that sort of history started a long time before that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, despite the fact that it being, you know, depending on how you want to look at it, fourth or fifth tier sport, because of the fact that, you know, American football, baseball, those are the traditionally, you know, powerhouse sports for this country. Soccer has a long history here in the United States. It just happens to coincide with a variety of other sports that took precedent for whatever reason. And my upbringing in the sport happened to come with a lull period where, you know, when the NASL that had the Cosmos and everything defunct in the early 80s, soccer kind of went underground for a little while. And then eventually, as football made a bit of a resurgence in the 1990s when we had the World Cup here, 1994 was the year that I graduated from high school and started college. So that was like this huge rebirth of the sport. And then in 1998, I went to the World Cup in France, and there's a whole, you know, sideline story to that. But ultimately, you know, it is something that has gone up and down and had a little bit of a tumultuous, but still there is a history there. And I think that the U.S. has a football/soccer future that I think is very bright.
Yeah, and I guess that's the thing. If you want a world sport, then it really does have to sort of include all the nations at the top of their game, doesn't it? And certainly the US is definitely one, I think, when it's challenging, is going to be a benefit for everybody sort of going forward. So take us into where the finance element came in and sort of the premise for sort of how these sort of two parts of your life sort of collided to create what you're creating now.
Yeah, absolutely. A few things that came together all at I'll say the right time, although it wasn't the best of times. It was during the pandemic where, you know, you had a lot of time to think, walk around. You know, I got into really good shape, and, you know, just there were so many things that you couldn't do that, given the right ingredients, to do things that you normally wouldn't do. And so I was having a discussion with one of my best friends, who is my co-author, and we were talking about finance, and, you know, it was just a few things that I wanted to tighten up in my own mind about my understanding of my own financial world. And as we were talking about it, I'm thinking about, you know, things that I would rather learn about, you know, the idea of like watching paint dry or something like that. I don't know if you guys have a better expression in England, but watching the grass grow or something along those lines. But, you know, I'm sitting there talking to my best friend about a topic that I really need to know about, but it really doesn't hold that interest. And I was thinking about it as like, well, he and I, the reason why we know each other and why we became best friends is because we played football/soccer in university together. And so I was like, if there was a way that we could relate this to the sport, I think it would make a lot more sense, A, and then B, it would hold my interest a little bit longer. And so we started that discussion during the pandemic, and the writing of the book took a lot longer than we ever would have liked for it to have taken, just because of the fact that we got out of the pandemic and you know, real life started back up, and, you know, several edits of the book afterwards. But ultimately, what we came up with, we were very happy with, in the fact that if you're a person who understands the sport of football and you're willing to, you know, take the time to kind of open up your brain to your football brain to letting in numbers and finance and things like that, all of a sudden you now have a framework for understanding your own financial life. And I think that that's one of the things that is extremely important, especially now with young people. That's my usual target audience, is people in that age range of like 16 to 26, where, you know, the world of finance is kind of tumultuous at the moment. And so understanding where you are is extremely important. And, you know, having that ability to manage your, in air quotes, club, and making sure that you're in a good financial spot, I think is going to become more and more important over the next decade.
So Take us into what that looks like. Like you say, how do you combine them sort of specifically? And I like that idea of sort of the owning the club and all those sort of different sort of areas that you're coordinating.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously being a football fan, you know, from a few years back, Barcelona at one point was the most dominant team in the world. And the way that they got there was by, you know, Pep Guardiola, who, you know, obviously is now at Man City, but was keeping the ball 80% of the time. And one of the things that we started the book off with was the idea of possession, not possessions. And, you know, growing up in the 1980s, it was very much a possessions-oriented mindset. People, you know, wanted the cars and money and, you know, all of that stuff. So ultimately, what we decided to look at was, okay, well, if each of the positions on the field was an asset class, so everybody that is on your team is an asset class, and then the defenders, the other team, is your liabilities. The things that, you know, the ways that you're going to give the ball away is the key. So, like, if you want to look at the game itself, your income stream, we're going to build out of the back, all right? And so basically you've got your goalkeeper is where the ball is going to start for the most part, and he's distributing out to, you know, any of your players. And we looked at the back line as things that were defensive in mindset, things like insurance, things like your savings account and those types of things. And then as you get a little bit farther forward in your midfield, those are going to be your, you know, they're going to move you forward, but they're not going to move you forward extremely quickly, your midfielders, things like your home purchase and things like that. And then as you get farther forward, things like stocks, bonds, etc., those things that can move your financial team, in air quotes, forward much more quickly, those are going to be the ones that we, you know, earmarked as your forwards, your Lionel Messis and all of those. So the whole entire thing is like keeping the, in air quotes, ball, which is your money, inside of your own team and not just giving it away to the other team just randomly. And I know that that's, you know, that's kind of a strategy in football at times where, you know, you're giving the ball to the other team in order to high press and things. But ultimately what our thought process was that Barcelona idea of you're keeping the 80% of possession of your ball, for lack of a better term, and that's what you're doing with your money. You're, you know, all right, you got $1,000 or 1,000 quid or whatever it is that you're dealing with, and you're putting that money where? Okay, well, if you're just giving it directly to Starbucks or Zaxby's or wherever it is, Nando's, you know, if you're giving all of your money away to other people, that's not setting your financial team up for, you know, a quality season in any way, shape, or form. And we also use the metaphor for a variety of other things. You know, obviously, being a fan of a League One team, the 46 games that you play within a season kind of lines up pretty well. I don't know what the age ranges are for people in the UK, but basically, if you graduate from university at 22, and the average retirement age in the US now is about 68, 46 plus 22, 68, that 46-year period kind of lines up with the game schedule, so it ends up being a thing of like, well, each year is kind of like a game. Did you win this game or did you lose this game? Because of the fact that at the end of the year, did you end up with more money in your pocket than you had the prior year? And are you setting yourself up to win games down the road where, you know, you're making investments today at 24, 25, 26 that are going to pay dividends at 45, 46, 47? And looking at the way that those early investments, you know, it's very similar to, you know, I always liken everything to my team, Peterborough United, is the fact that we had a policy of buying young and hungry players, where it was, you're doing things that are going to pay dividends later on. We bought players that we knew weren't good enough to, you know, play at this level, at the championship level right now, but they will be there in 3 years. And so that's kind of the idea behind a lot of the financial ideas. I mean, I'm giving you a little bit more specific concepts that we talked about in the book, but the overarching concept is how can you take a financial concept and relate it to something that you and I as football fans already understand.
Yeah, and I love the multifaceted sort of area that you talk about there, because it's a little bit like, I mean, my daughter's 16 now, so that sense of she's just got her first job, but like you say, it's that kind of, yeah, let's go out and spend it. And then it's that kind of, but are you thinking about buying a car? Do you want to buy a car? Is that going to, that facility going to help you get a different job later on? You know, university and college and all that, thoughts, that sort of thing aside. And it's only when, like you say, you can really see that, you know, what am I doing now for the future? What's my sort of disposable? What am I investing in? I mean, it seems really young to be thinking about pensions when you're like early 20s, but it's that kind of, it's certainly one of the best things I ever did. And that was just someone saying, just do it. If you can afford it, if you can put it in, if you can make it work, then go for it. And like I say, if you're not having these conversations, then you don't know anything about it, which is the great thing about having the podcast, to be able to chat about these things, but also to bring in sort of like, say, elements that maybe you wouldn't be aware of, because they're sort of one step removed from the here's the cash, now I'm going to spend it. Because like you say, you've got this sort of longevity and planning going on.
Yeah. And one of the first things that we talk about, which, you know, is I've been on other podcasts and talked to other people, and, you know, they say, well, what's the most important skill that you need in order to get good with your finances? And more than anything, I say it's emotional control. It's that being in the moment of I'm at the store, I'm with my friends, and it's recognizing the decision process that you're making. It's not you're reacting to the emotion. I want this thing, and therefore I am going to buy it in this moment. It's being willing to take a step back and just making a real decision. There's nothing wrong with, you know, oh, I want to go out for a, you know, I don't know if Starbucks is as big over there as it is over here, but, you know, that Starbucks coffee, which is, you know, $5 or $7 or, you know, 5 quid, whatever it happens to be, is, it's fine for you to buy that, but recognizing the fact that you're making a financial decision, you're not making an emotional decision. It's, I need this thing, and therefore I have the money in my pocket, and I'm going to spend it on this. If you make that decision consistently, that's completely fine, but you're recognizing why you're making that decision, as opposed to, you know, it's just happening to you. I think that a lot of, you know, especially young people, they get the money in their pocket and, you know, it's, oh, well, I want to buy this thing because of the fact that I have the money now. Well, that's great. And, you know, I'll use my my daughter as a example, since you mentioned yours. My daughter's 15, and one of her favorite bands is this band Lovejoy from the UK, and they're coming to the US, and it's, all right, if you want us to be able to get tickets for that, you're going to need to be able to contribute to that. So that's a time where, you know, all right, well, you're giving up some of these small short-term things that you would normally want to get, but that bigger type of purchase is something that you really want. So being able to have the emotional control in those moment to moments where you're deciding, I'm going to give up all of these small things so that I can get this bigger thing. And that's a lesson that I think that we all can learn as early as possible, because of the fact that it compounds over time, just like so many of those other lessons that we get either in school or in life, where the earlier that you learn some of those hard lessons from, you know, if I can learn this at 16 as opposed to 36, you're going to be way ahead of the game.
And I think also, like you say, the grey area of it, I think, is a really fascinating thing for me. And by that, I mean the fact that there is the here and now in the moment, and today is really important. And like you say, the buying a coffee is neither here nor there. However, it might be that that particular coffee is with a friend who really needs a conversation, in which case it's well worth not the financial investment, but the fact that there's more to it than that. And like, say, the flip side is the fact I could take or leave it. I'm just doing it out of habit because I walk by it every day. But I know that, you know, if I just stop doing what I'm doing out of habit and I've got half or all the money for a concert ticket or something which is going to be an experience, which is what we're talking about, you know, having life in the moment or something which is really something I'm after, then that makes as well, it makes a really important sort of emotional connection, but in a positive way, I think. And I think that's really a fascinating thing for me, because it's having that maturity and, like I say, having those mature conversations and ideas at a younger age to be able to put those things in place makes the bigger decisions. Like I say, when we're talking about an investment for 25 years or, you know, however long your mortgage is going to be on your house, or deciding not to have a mortgage because you want to do something else, it comes with all of those sort of ideas, and there's no right or wrong, and your friends might be doing it slightly differently. But I think as long as you can talk your way through it and say, this is why I'm doing it and this is my sort of real motivation for it, then, like I say, you've got a really sort of good good foundation then for what you're going to take forward in all aspects of that sort of financial and I guess your emotional life.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's one of the reasons why the football metaphor is so great, because there's a variety of different ways to go about it. You know, again, going back to, you know, whoever your team happens to be, there's all kinds of strategies, and there's no lack of fans who are going to look at the way that their club is run and say, you know, oh, well, we should be buying players who are really experienced championship players. And yeah, they're going to be on more money, but we're going to go that route, as opposed to we're bringing up National League players and trying to give them their first opportunity at EFL. Those are the types of things where every single Sunday, Monday, whatever, people have no lack of opinions about the way that their chairman or their manager or whatever are running their club. However, when it's your decisions, when it's your financial world that you are dealing with on a daily basis, there's nobody else to blame. You know, it's so simple to go onto Twitter and say, you know, oh, our management team isn't doing the right things. That's the easiest thing in the world. The easiest thing in the world is to criticize how other people are running your club or whatever. But it's your financial world. Then you are making all of the decisions. And your example earlier of the coffee with the friend who needs that at that moment, that's a completely reasonable and, you know, in my estimation, it's a worthwhile purchase. It's definitely a thing. But that's the idea of the concept, is like, you know, you're making the decisions. You can't blame anybody else for the fact that your financial world is set up this particular way, because you are the one who, you know, again, going back to the metaphor of the different levels of the, you know, backs, for mids and forwards, it's the if most people only have their back line and that's it, they've never invested in any forwards, and, you know, having been a fan for years, everybody's like, oh, we need to buy a really, you know, high level forward. But when they're dealing with their own life, they're only, you know, they have their checking account, they have their savings account, they have their insurance, but they don't really have a lot of ways to move themselves forward financially. And that's, you know, that's part of the plan, is figuring out, okay, well, I'm a 22-year-old, and maybe investing in the stock market is not something that most 22-year-olds are thinking about. They're thinking about going out for, you know, a beer with their friends on Friday. But at the same time, is that something that you want to do in order to set yourself up for success later on down the road, whatever you define that is? Because, you know, that's one of the other things that we get into, is the levels of success, and you see it all the time. It's, you know, if you're a Manchester City, you're a Manchester United, a Chelsea, Arsenal, if you're outside of the top four, that's failure. But if you are a Fulham or a, you know, Norwich, you know, being in the Premiership and being, you know, mid-table is success. So again, defining that idea of what your financial success looks like, because it's not going to be the same for everybody. You know, I have no aspirations, although, you know, I would love for it to happen, but it's not the way that I've set up my life to be, you know, a multimillionaire. It never really was something that I had as a goal by any stretch of the imagination. I take care of my family. I do those types of things. And that's what success means to me. But for you, you know, you might have a totally different set of standards, and recognizing the fact that the moves that you're making on a daily or weekly or yearly basis are hurting or helping your ability to reach those financial goals.
And I guess flexibility is a really important factor, isn't it? I was just sort of thinking about sort of the Pep and Man City sort of scenario. The team that he started with when he first became manager isn't anywhere like the team that it is now. And that's partly because he's evolved from being a great manager to probably an even greater manager. But also the players that have come into his world are different. And so he set up the way he goes about running his team differently as well. So, you know, when you've got like a Haaland up front, you're going to set that up differently. When you've got someone at the back who's able to run so fast like Kyle Walker does, that you know you've got a little bit of extra security there, which even if you wanted it, you couldn't necessarily think would be the case unless you had those particular assets in place. But knowing that that's okay, because I'll make that decision based on where I am now and I'll plan for the future. And then when that changes, I'm happy to change with it as well, because I know I've got the thought processes and the skills and the understanding to be flexible with it as well. And I think then you get away from that, I need to do it right, I need to make sure I don't make a mistake, because you know you can sort of make it work for you wherever you happen to be. Because of course the reality is that it may well be this is working fantastically now, but I know my life will have to look different if I have a child, for example. You know, the hours in the day are going to be different, where I want to spend my time, the amount of time I have with my friends and whatever those things happen to be are going to look different. But I know that's fine, because I know I'm going to be able to, I've made the decisions now that I think are going to work, and if they did or didn't work or whatever, I can change them, like say mid-season, end of the season, you know, transfer a couple of things and then we'll start next year, and the whole thing just becomes part of the journey. And then I think there's some security in that, in the lack of security, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and you know, again, we're talking about a 46-year, with the way we've set it up, a swath of time where everything, exactly, you hit the nail on the head, is the idea of the 22-year-old starting out. You know, when I was 22, I still lived with my parents, you know, and that ability to save money on things like rent. Yes, you're not making as much, but at the same time, you have a lot more unallocated capital, and putting it into a variety of different other areas that you might not have the freedom to do later. You know, when you're in your late 20s, early 30s, you know, if you're, again, similar to what I was, I had, you know, my kids right around 30, and I wasn't able to put money into things like stocks and bonds and things like that because of the fact that I just didn't have that, you know, liquid capital to move it in those directions. So recognizing the fact that you're setting up for a long season, you know, if you were a manager of a team, you know, you got to recognize the fact that you're going to have injuries and things like that. But in the real world where we're talking about finances, it's, you know, all right, well, I'm 22 years old and I know that I want to have a family, and that's something that's on my radar. I don't have those restrictions on myself now. So using the assets that I have at the moment, in order to, rather than giving all of that money to the pub on Friday night, maybe I cut back a little bit. You don't have to not live, but giving a little bit of that to your future so that it slowly grows exponentially over the years, because, you know, if you stay invested in a variety of different things, you know, over the years, the compound interest that you pick up on things really picks up over time. And if you start to see those compounds over, you know, cut it from 20 to 30, go up to 30 years or 40 years, then all of a sudden you're making a lot more money on your compounded interest over time. So it's, again, that idea of making these decisions early enough where you get to see all of the fruits of making that short-term kind of sacrifice, if you will, but you end up seeing the benefits of it in the long term. And that's one of the human race's, you know, difficult things is we tend not to look long term. We tend to look very short term and make a lot of decisions, you know, emotionally based on the fact that we're thinking short term as opposed to long term.
And I think that's important to realize how difficult that is. I mean, you only have to sort of take climate as an example. You know, we know the long term, and even now we're making short term differences just because there's an election going on or because we need to do this. And even when you know that there's a kind of a really important reason for making a decision, and, you know, like you say, whether that's, you know, I want to make sure I've got a deposit for a mortgage, or, you know, put my kids through college, whatever it happens to be, you know, I'm still going to, like you say, spend that extra money in the pub just because it's whatever I do. I think appreciating that it's not necessarily as straightforward as we sort of talk about it, I think is really key. And if you had any sort of feedback from sort of people who sort of read the book in terms of that kind of, oh, it makes so much sense like that, and or also that kind of people just starting on their journey saying, oh no, I really do now have that, sort of had that penny drop, which I wouldn't have done before.
Yeah, for the most part, you know, and this is one of the difficult things with you know, having the target audience that you're talking about is, you know, that 16 to 26 year old. It's difficult to get them to buy into the idea of, like, I need to be thinking about this right now. It's not our target audience, but the audience that we're hitting the most frequently is the people in their early 40s and stuff who have kids in that target demo, that they are saying, oh my gosh, my son, my daughter needs to know this right now. My friend and co-author is a financial planner, and so he gives presentations all the time to, you know, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s about their financial life, and he uses the concepts. Sometimes, depending on, you know, the person that he's talking to, sometimes he'll actually use the terminology that we use from this, because if he knows that they're a soccer fan or a football fan, he'll actually use it, and that becomes the conversation of, oh, my daughter, my son, you know, my niece, my nephew all need to hear this thing. So what our plan is, and I just finished up my fall season, I'm a coach at the school where I teach, and my season just ended up. So now what our plan is to go out and give presentations and things like that, because of the fact that going out to a club and, you know, putting some of these ideas out, not putting all of them out, but enough that a kid in their teens, 20s will see, oh, okay, well, this actually makes a lot of sense, and it relates to something that I care about. You know, at bare minimum, giving the book, giving the presentation, giving the ideas a little bit of their time and attention, that's where we're hopeful that, you know, we're going to start to see the feedback come in from, you know, the younger generation of, like, well, what we really need to do is a video series. And, like, I have two kids. I recognize the fact that they're not reading books as much as they probably should be. It's going to be short videos or presentations or things like that, where we can grab attention a little bit more simply, rather than, you know, oh, here's a, you know, we kept the book extremely short. We did that on purpose. I've written three books, and all of them were intended for teenagers. And the first thing anyone who I've, you know, suggested the idea to, they were like, keep it under 100 pages. I'm like, okay, no problem. I can do that, because of the fact that it becomes a short read. They don't have to read it in order. It's not like cover to cover. It doesn't need to be. If you know you're having trouble with a particular part of your, you know, financial world, is you can actually take a look at it from that perspective.
And I think it's a really important point that you make there, because I think as the grown-ups, I think sometimes it's just the more experienced people that we are as parents and educators. It's that sense of, we know this is important, so we need to kind of bring it into our world, into our life, as it were, you know. And the education system currently is so prescriptive in so many ways, you know. it works and it doesn't work in so many different facets. But I think as parents, like you say, oh, we need to make sure that financials are really important. There are sort of two sides to that. One is the fact that we're going to take care of the financials because we want to look after our kids. And you mentioned the odd thing. But as soon as, like say, you've opened this discussion up to say, I need to make sure that they're aware of this and how we can have these conversations. Even like I say, it's the book on the coffee table. It's the, oh, I've just been watching this video. However, you like say you decide to sort of then package it, makes a big difference. And I think the reason I sort of take heart with that is the fact that I think certainly my kids' generation, you know, their understanding of, you know, healthy eating, fitness, lifestyle is a much more productive and proactive one than it certainly seemed to be from sort of my generation. And I think that sort of really has an encouragement of kind of, if you're having these conversations, if you're putting it out there, then actually, as we all know, kids generally will take the better path for their sort of well-being. It's a little bit like the sort of, you know, giving them vegetables and that kind of thing. There was a great thing I saw on telly where they had a group of young children in a house and they were basically looking after themselves, you know. So the first few days they're just eating pizza and having all this sort of stuff, and by like day two or three they're kind of like, do you know what, I fancy a vegetable and some fruit, because your body starts to tell you that this isn't working. And I think from the financial point of view it's the same thing. It's like, oh, we could just do this, but very quickly they'll go, actually I want more money, because actually this is what I'd like to buy, or this is the sort of thing I'd like my life to be. And I just think the correlation between those two things, having faith in our kids and knowing that they'll make the decisions because inherently they know what's good, as long as they've got the information and the awareness, then giving them the skills and the ability to take that forward, I think is probably a great idea.
Yeah, and you know, the idea of the information, getting the information into the hands in a into their hands in a palatable way, that, you know, it's not just, you know, numbers and figures and everything like that, and having some kind of a, you know, in air quotes, authority figure, whether it's a teacher, a coach, a parent, or something along those lines, you know, showing them giving them options, you know, because of the fact that here in the United States, I don't know, you know, the demographics for the UK, but one of the greatest indicators for your financial success in the US is your zip code, where you live. It's because of the fact that your experience of the world influences the decisions that you make. And as you look around the places where you live, it's, oh, well, everybody else that is living in my area is living paycheck to paycheck. Nobody has any savings or anything like that. Or it's everybody in my, you know, my kind of line of sight is invested in, you know, the stock market and things like that. It's the things that you experience on a daily and yearly basis. You see them, and then your education kind of comes out of that. And that's one of the reasons why I think this is so important, is because of the fact that you're absolutely right. A lot of times when given the information, kids have a tendency to make the right call. But if you only get one perspective because of where you live or, you know, your upbringing and things like that, you don't know any different perspective. And so that idea of, you know, all right, well, we're going to eat pizza for the first couple of days, but then we switch over to the vegetables because of the fact that we know that that's the right maneuver. If somebody has never seen a vegetable before on their plate, they're never going to make that decision. So it's making that access to the resources in order to say, okay, here are some possible ideas so that you can possibly make a better decision, and eventually you hope that this has a generational effect that, you know, that leads to a better education for, you know, that kid who's 22 picks up this book and makes some better decisions over their thing, their lifetime, hopefully passes it on to their kids, the good habits. It doesn't matter to me whether the book gets passed along, it's more that the idea gets passed along. And you know, going back to the whole football metaphor, it's why I believe, you know, that the United States is bound to be a great footballing nation, is because of the fact that we're only in, like, you know, generation two. I refer to myself as a first generation, you know, soccer or football fan slash player, my son would be generation two because of the fact that I was the first one who started it and started playing in my family, and then now my son plays, and then hopefully, you know, as it goes along. You talk about England, the UK in general, you're talking about being generation, I don't know, 13 or 14 possibly, where your grandfather and great-grandfather probably were football fans of particular clubs and things like that. So I think we're on the verge of an explosion in regards to the US. And I think that that's the same kind of concept that you can run into, is if we could have a variety of different people making better financial decisions, where it becomes a more pervasive idea. I feel like a lot of people in the United States, especially possibly in the UK, it's we're living paycheck to paycheck, and we're kind of in a bit of a survival mode because of the fact that it's not been an idea that has really gotten introduced to the masses. It's, you know, this is how to be sound financially. I think that is going to be a transformative thing if we can get that idea across. And my co-author and I, the whole entire reason why we wrote the book as a football or soccer book is because of the fact that that's the sport that we're passionate about. But we're going to do one for American football, basketball, baseball, any other sport that we think that we can make the metaphor work, so that, you know, the American football book, for example, it's a really easy transition from the soccer one to the American football one. But my hope is that if we get enough sports that we can give this metaphor to younger people, that it becomes a pervasive idea where it's like, oh, finances work just like sports, and my team isn't doing well, and that has a societal or a cultural impact, as opposed to just I impacted one kid. That's great. I love that. You know, as a teacher, I love the one kid in the class that I have a really real impact on, but I would really love to see it become a, you know, connect the dots type of thing, where you're getting hundreds and thousands of people who are getting that cultural impact.
And I think that the big thing for me, I was thinking there was the fact that because of that perception change, then it can happen like that very quickly, can't it? Because like you said, you know, I can't see a world outside of this because it's only in my periphery of, you know, everyone's paycheck to paycheck, etc., etc., because this is where we live and the zip code and all of that. As soon as that very quick change suddenly turns around to be, actually, it's because they didn't know the information they needed to make a difference, then we're in great shape, because then you suddenly think it doesn't matter about my zip code, because no matter what my situations, my circumstances are, whatever, I can kind of change that, mix it up, and I can make the next step, and then that's going to make a massive difference moving forward. And that's almost like a light bulb change at that point.
You hit the nail right on the head, 100%, that, you know, that idea of the access then becomes the key component to making some form of a shift. Going back to the club idea of, until Peterborough United got a new chairman, you know, we were living paycheck to paycheck, very much so. We were, you know, barely staying in the football league. There was talk of bankruptcy. Barry Fry mortgaged his home several times and everything like that. But then you get a new chairman in who has a new set of ideas and stuff. And yes, he influxed cash, but at the same time, it's a new perception on how you should run your club, as opposed to, you know, well, what we do is we pay our bills and we bring in players and we try and sell players. And, you know, this strategy wasn't working. And now we've got a new focus on the way that we're going to go about our business. And it just makes for a better overall, financial situation in the finance world, and then also, you know, the running of your club ends up working in a much, much more positive direction.
Yeah, and it's such an important point, because, like I say, the influx of cash is fine, except the cash will run out no matter how much it is very quickly if the ideas don't change or you're not on a different path. So, yeah, I think that's really important.
Yeah, that's why, you know, I forget what the statistic is, but something like 97% of lottery winners end up going back to their, you know, financial level after a certain number of years because of the fact that they don't know how to manage the amount of money. And it's real easy for anybody from the outside to look at, you know, oh, you just won $10 million or whatever and say, how did you squander that? It's because of the fact that, you know, you haven't built the skills in order to do it. And so recognizing the fact that it's the skills that really, you know, pay the bills rather than the you know, the influx of cash. It's real easy to, you know, think that cash is the only thing that is going to solve your problem. But really, if you're smart about it, you can do it with just about any level of income. It's just figuring out the right strategies.
Yeah. And is there an education experience or a teacher that you remember that you'd like to share? And I'm always really interested how that fits in with, like, say, someone who's involved in education and specifically, you know, today we're obviously talking about the finance in the book, but yeah, just either sort of good or bad, because I know sort of those experiences can be taken both ways sometimes.
Yeah, no, it was you know, in high school, I had a teacher who he ended up being my neighbor when I was in my 30s. But anyway, Mr. Bose was my algebra 2 teacher, and then he ended up being my calculus teacher. And I think the major thing that that he did, and I think that all great teachers do, is it wasn't just about the content; it was about who we were as people. Like, he took time to get to know me and my classmates about, like, you know, obviously I was playing soccer at the time and things like that. He took the time to care about those types of things. And then in college, university, I had a professor, Dr. Knowles, who, again, that same type of thing where I wasn't just a student in his class. I was a person, and, like, he spoke at my wedding. I spoke at his funeral a few years ago. It was one of those things where the relationship was more important than the information. I think that's one of the things that we have a tendency to lose from time to time. Not in the classroom so much, but at the administration level and things like that. I think that we've lost that recognition that it's more about the relationships. It's how you get along with the people in the room and the confidence or lack thereof that you can build in a young person through those relationships that really, you know, shines through over the years, because of the fact that, you know, I'm a Spanish teacher and I love my ability to speak foreign languages. I think it's really awesome. But at the same time, I also have this recognition in the back of my head where if a student that I'm teaching at the Spanish 1 level goes on in their life and they never speak Spanish again, but they've built up a confidence to, you know, talk to people, or they learned a way that, like, you know, the way that language is structured from my class, or they start to figure out, okay, well, there's a different way to look at the world based on how I learned a foreign language. If they get those things, I'm not so concerned that they become fluent and start traveling to, you know, Spain or South America or anything like that. I'm not overly concerned about those things, but I do care that they become a more well-rounded person based on the fact that they were in my classroom.
Yeah, I love that. And it's such a important message, and it comes across more and more. And I think I love the fact that when you have these threads through all the different topics that we talk about, that those human relations and the conversations are so key. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given? Or indeed, is there a piece of advice you might give your younger self? And I love this from what we were saying before about the book, because, of course, like you said, it might be as a younger person you wouldn't take this on board because it wasn't part of your immediate sort of knowledge. But actually, without knowing it, you wouldn't know how to take it forward.
Yeah, you know, the most pervasive idea that in advice that I've ever gotten that, you know, has paid me the most dividends, and I feel kind of weird about saying it that way, but you know, my father, his big piece of advice was, you know, be nice to people. It doesn't cost you anything, but it can get you everything. And I think that, you know, if you get caught up on that last part of the line, it sounds kind of greedy, but it's that idea of, like, you know, you can put good things out into the world and really not expect anything back, but that's one of the key components to the world becoming a better place overall, is that if everybody's thinking about, like, oh, well, you know, I can't give until I get, that's a really problematic situation. And I feel like that's where we are at the moment in a lot of ways, is people are always thinking about, okay, well, what's the back end? If I give you this, how am I going to get back? It's kind of that idea of, like, all right, just put good out into the world and then consider the fact that it's going to come back eventually, but don't really get transactional in the situation, because of the fact that, you know, I'm a teacher, obviously, and I get asked often, you know, hey, Mr. Urich, if I do this homework assignment or I get an 80% on this quiz, you know, how will it affect my grade? And it's like, just do the best that you can, and then we'll see where the chips fall, because of the fact that, you know, if it's always transaction mode, people aren't incentivized to do much of anything, because the payoff is the only thing that they're worried about. And I don't really want to, not that I don't want to live in a world, I want to live in the world regardless, but I would much rather live in a world where people are willing to give first and, you know, recognize the fact that things are going to come back to them eventually. That idea, you know, it's one of those things that I've actually got a t-shirt that I made years ago, which was soccer karma. If you give a good ball, you're going to get a good ball. Meaning that if you are playing on the pitch and you give somebody a good ball, you're more likely to get a good ball back eventually. And if everybody is thinking in that kind of concept where I'm going to give the best ball that I possibly can, then that becomes something that kind of infects the rest of the team. And if everybody's thinking about how can I do the best for the person that I'm giving the ball to, then I think you end up in a much better scenario.
Yeah, I love that. It's such an important thing. Is there a resource you'd like to share? And this can be personal, professional, anything from a podcast, video, film, book, but yeah, something that's has an impact.
I mean, over the years, now I've like, you know, been listening to podcasts and watching YouTube videos and things like that for years. Probably, you know, if a friend was asking me, hey, I've never listened to a podcast before, I really would like to hear something that, like, would have a positive impact on my life. There's one, it's called Impact Theory with Tom Bilyeu. He started the nutrition company Quest a little while back. I don't know if that's made its way over into the UK or not, but basically Quest was a nutrition bar / they do potato chips and a variety of other things. But the whole entire thing was built as a company to make, you know, in air quotes, junk food that was good for you. And if you could make a better decision about what you were going to eat, like, you know, package it like junk food, but it's actually relatively healthy, and then eventually start getting you, you know, down the path of making better, better decisions health wise. He started going in a different direction, and he started this thing called Impact Theory, which is basically, you know, an entertainment group, but he does a weekly or bi-weekly podcast, and it's really good stuff. He goes into a variety of different areas between nutrition, but also mindset and things like that. And it's really worth the listen.
Fantastic. And we'll have links to all of these things that we're chatting about today on the show notes, so you can just click through there as well. And then just finally, the acronym FIRE is really important for us here at Education on Fire. And by that, we mean feedback, inspiration, resilience, and empowerment. What is it that just strikes you when you hear that?
So I've got my own, you know, personal, you know, coaching philosophy, and my thing is the three P's, which are progress, persistence, and then passion. And so all three of those, although they're not the same exact words that you're using, the one that jumps out to me is persistence / resilience, is that idea of staying with something, because of the fact that I think that that's something that we've lost a little bit of, is that idea of I'm going to stick with this regardless of whether or not I'm, you know, getting the accolades or something along those lines, or I'm seeing results right away. You know, almost anything that is worth having is going to require some level of persistence, resilience, or whatever. Those, that's probably the, you know, the one that jumps out at me from the beginning. And then the empowerment thing, I think that it's an idea that we definitely need to recognize that we are the solution to most of our own problems. Is, you know, there's a Batman episode that, from the cartoon series that I reference quite often. I actually ripped it off from somebody else, but basically it's this thing of, you know, Bruce Wayne gets kidnapped. He has amnesia. He can't remember who he is, but he keeps on hearing his captors talking about Batman, you know, whether or not Batman's going to come and, you know, cause them problems. And he's getting mad. He's like, when is Batman going to come save me? When is Batman going to come save me? And then eventually he remembers, oh, I'm Batman. And he, you know, breaks through the, you know, the cage that he's in and all that stuff and frees himself. And I think that's one of the things that we have to get back to, is recognizing that we're the solution to our own problems for the most part. You know, obviously there's things that happen on a global scale that, you know, we can influence slightly, but in our own life, you know, don't anticipate that the government is going to come and help you out or anything like that. You've got to solve most of your own problems, and you have the ability to do that. But if you look at yourself as, you know, a phrase I used to use all the time was, you know, don't assume you're weak because you haven't found your strength yet. And that's one of the things that I think that especially the younger generation, it's like, oh, well, you know, I didn't figure out what my strength is really quickly, so therefore I'm going to give up on everything. And I think that we all have an ability, a power within us that if we use it, if we take hold of it, then we're going to be way better off than if we just assume that we're weak.
Yeah, I love it. And I think just sort of tying it all completely back into the book, I think that sense of finding the thing that you're passionate about and using that in a way that's going to support you with all of your learning in whichever way that comes is going to, like I say, keep your interest and give you what you need to kind of take that next step and put your best foot forward. So, Pete, thank you so much for sharing all of this wisdom. I really, really appreciate it. It's great being able to have a proper conversation about football as well, which is something we don't do on the podcast very much, which I absolutely loved. So, yeah, make sure share with people where they can find out more about you and obviously about the book and everything.
Yeah. You know, at the moment, since we've only done the football book or the soccer book, it's sportsfinancellc.com is our website, but eventually it's not going to be just the soccer book. It'll be the American football, the basketball and things like that. But once those things come into fruition, the Sports Finance LLC is going to be the umbrella under which we keep all of this stuff. So that's why we started off with that rather than, you know, the book itself is called Financial Goals or Setting and Scoring Financial Goals, but the overall caption is, you know, Financial Goals. If you look for it in my last name on the website or on the internet, you'll find it without a doubt.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Thank you so much indeed. Really appreciate your time. Keep up the great work with Peterborough. And if you're ever here for a live match, I'm literally down the road within an hour. So yeah, make sure you give me a call and pop by.
I will absolutely take you up on that, Mark.
Thank you for listening and being part of this wonderful community. With over 300 episodes, I've collated 20 resources from guests that have been on the show to help you in your educational journey and those of you involved with young people. Just go to educationonfire.com and you can sign up on the homepage. Thanks for listening to the Education on Fire podcast. For more information of each episode and to get in touch, go to educationonfire.com. Education is not the filling of a pail, but the lighting of a fire.